We've got less than a month until the Epsom Derby, and Aidan O'Brien is threatening to turn it into a one-man show. Can anyone stop the Ballydoyle juggernaut? Welcome to the front page. The last 7 days have felt like a flat season compressed into a single week. We've had Ballydoyle dominance, a ground safety row. We've had aftershocks from a bombshell in British Racing's governance. And on the sales scene, we've had some key insights into the direction of travel for British and European racing. We will be going through it all today. And for that, I'm lucky to be joined by the perfect panel, Maddie Pleo and Peter Scargill. Welcome both. Let's dive straight into the classics, because it's been an interesting one, because Aidan O'Brien's been hoovering up the trials, and it was looking like it was going to be embarrassingly one-sided on Epsom Downs, Maddie. But after the weekend, it's a little bit more nuanced, where we had a couple of results going against Ballydoyle after their dominance at Chester. Let's start with Chester, though, because that was a main affair last week, and we had a couple of very impressive Derby trials for O'Brien, with Benvenuto Cellini and Constitution River both winning in large margins. What were you impressed by most?
I think Benvenuto Cellini, that's how I'm going with the pronunciation. It's quite fun, isn't it? Yes, the time was very strong. I thought this is the ground that he wants. You know, he's out of Newspaper of Record, who was a Breeders' Cup winner on very, very fast ground. And for me, he was kind of the number one in the pecking order last year. And that futurity run, I think Aidan O'Brien will probably just write off as saying we never should have run him because he just didn't want that really soft ground. As I say, impressive time. Loved the way he stretched away at the end. Think he'd be more suited by a more sort of wider track. Obviously, Epsom is tricky and it has its undulations, but it is a bit more galloping than Chester in its nature. So yes, I thought he was very good, albeit the opposition not particularly strong, but you can say that for a lot of the trials. I thought Constitution River was also brilliant. I would just say as a D stakes winner, it's not as, doesn't tend to be as a direct Derby trial as the Cheshire Bars. So yes, he was very good, but I wouldn't be surprised if they shuffle the pack somewhat and he goes over maybe a shorter trip.
Yeah, we have a O'Brien opened Gallops morning taking place today. So we'll likely find out more. That'll be covered in silverandracingpost.com. Pete, what were you taken by last week from the O'Brien ranks?
Well, I like Constitution River, albeit that race came after the ground kerfuffle.
Menoshti came out.
Exactly. So again, it's the quality of the opposition is open to interpretation. I found Amelia Earhart quite interesting. And I'm going to tell you one. I was watching the race with my wife, Tina, and we both thought it was unusual, the headgear that was employed on this horse, a hood and some blinkers. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but it's like we felt it was unusual to see O'Brien horses in headgear to begin with, let alone...
What did you take from that?
That I wouldn't want to be backing the horse he's now favourite for the Oaks around Epsom on Derby, Oaks Day.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had a few Camelots go there, I think like Pink Dogwood, who've gone with big reputations and something more straightforward than and end up winning at Epsom in the Oaks. So visually impressive, unusual, to use Aidan's own word, headgear. Not certain about Epsom is my takeaway from that. Boil it down into bullet points.
Okay. After seeing what she did in her one of her maidens, wasn't it, when she was given a smack on one side and she practically veered into the rail. Obviously, there's greenness and you can make allowances for that. But yeah, they're kind of contradictory headgears, aren't they? I mean, usually you would think you put a hood on to calm a horse down, and you put blinkers on to sharpen them up. I mean, she's clearly a very quirky girl. Very talented too, but yeah, I wouldn't be backing her.
No, if Ryan Moore's on board at Epsom, he will be at... You know, he'll have to be at his very best to negotiate around there, you'd have thought.
Well, would you be sticking with the horse that unfortunately now is forevermore going to be labelled as the new Enable, John Gosden's?
Yeah, I mean, you know, she ran a perfectly nice trial. Rafe Beckett's horse, Ala Prochaine, third also ran a good trial, you'd say. Rafe obviously knows how to get an Oaks winner. You know, we're so early in the season, we're so early in these horses' careers that there's so many reasons not to go with the favourite that you'd think if you went deeper down, there must be something there to shake it up to. I mean, there's, you know, they're going to be employing tactics to get this horse fired up or not fired up, depending on which headgear she responds to. Or so yes,
pros and downers, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, it was an interesting week of trials with, you know, Linkfield and what have you. You know, O'Brien team winning that race with Cameo, and Godolphin just bombing out again. I mean, I just wonder
my talking point. Yeah,
I just wonder if it's going to be another one of those years where Charlie Appleby goes, "Do you know what? Nah, this is, you're a bit for me this year. We'll go do France, and we'll go do
0 from 17 the last fortnight. Many running well below form. King's Trail 16-1 for the Dante this week. Best shortest price Derby contender. What's going on?
Well, I don't know. We need to get Charlie on to explain himself. What's going on, Charlie? It's unusual. We've become so used to Godolphin snatching the initiative of the season. And that's going, oh, it's just the year they could do it. And then we move on to these trials and Bally Doyle steamrolled everyone and go, oh, well, that was short-lived for Godolphin. But I say this year they haven't got started. You know, Sheikh Mohammed's dipped back into the breeze up markets to supplement the team. You'd have to be concerned, say, in terms of how represented they're going to be this year. So, say, in the past, when they've not had the quality of horse, they've not really turned up in Europe. They've gone off and won races elsewhere.
Yeah, this was the talking point I was saying about earlier that I think we needed to talk about, is just how sort of how much they're struggling to find form. And you look at Royal Ascot last year, and Rebel's Romance was kind of the saviour. I mean, what an amazing horse he is, but in isolation, he's not enough to prop up the whole enterprise, I guess. And you know, they don't seem to have targeted that meeting as much as other sort of ownership outfits, certainly not of their similar size, in the last couple of years. So I'm not sure that bodes particularly well either. I wonder, there'd be a virus in the yard or something like that.
Possibly. I mean, it's just
they'd sort of take root in new market yards. Like,
well, they can do. I mean, Molson Paddocks is outside of the town, and they do their training privately, so they wouldn't have the same sort of interaction. There's obviously the people going in that yard, but I mean, I've not heard any suggestions along those lines.
Look at the form. You know, 0 from 17 last fortnight, like I say, many of them running well below form.
Yeah.
You know, clearly the horses aren't running at the level that we'd expect.
Yeah. So yeah, we can't.
Myriad reasons why that could be the case, of which virus is one. But you know, this is we see this happening on a regular basis. Yards going through dips like this. And of course, most famously, Nicky Henderson pulling all his horses out of Cheltenham a couple of years ago because of a virus. But this is the worst time of the season, really, for that. You know, you've got Epsom coming, and then hot on its heels of Royal Ascot. Yeah, if Godolphin are not well represented there, not only is that bad news for Godolphin, but it leaves a big hole, as I think we've seen with the sort of the Derby market being really cool more heavy.
Saeed's been among the winners. I mean, he hasn't been given the firepower in recent years.
Not been any horses.
Whether it's a yard isolated thing. Like you say, that would make sense if it was a virus or something, but we don't know. But fingers crossed for their teams it turns around.
Let's look at the weekend trials though, because it didn't go all O'Brien's way, although it did go for another O'Brien, Joseph, who struck in Leopardstown Derby trial with James J. Braddock as Pierre Bonnard fluffed his lines. What did you make of that performance, Maddie?
Yeah, I really liked that horse. Really liked him. He was obviously behind in that Bally Sachs, was it? Behind Christmas Day. Loved the attitude he showed, and I thought that sort of end result, even if he hadn't won, he shaped really well, and he showed the promise that he was probably the better horse in the race. As for Pierre Bonnard, like we've touched upon earlier with Amelia Earhart, he is a Camelot, and I think you can see that.
Yeah, he's got a bit of touch of the old Los Angeles about him.
See that in the closing stages, can't you? I don't know whether he sort of slightly cocked his jaw, didn't want to go past the pacemaker endorsement. Was it endorsement, I think? So, yes, I do have a slight query about his attitude now. But at the same time, it seems to be quite a significant backward step he's taken. I mean, this is a horse who was winning Group Ones in the style of a really, really smart one. So odd that, given, you know, the first run, maybe given the excuses to blow away the cobwebs, this was his opportunity. You'd have been expecting him to win and win handsomely, and he just couldn't do it. So, you know, there's clearly, with these very good horses, they're not always straightforward in their pedigree, particularly when they have that Monjeu in them through Camelot, I think.
No, it's a complex picture right now. And another one that got thrown into the mix was Maltese Cross at Lingfield, becoming, by dint of winning, Britain's leading Epsom, Derby candidate.
The least enthusiastic build up to Britain's leading Derby candidate that's ever been put forward by those other racing fans.
What do you think? What did you think? Would you be more enthusiastic?
I like the idea that he's owned by a film producer.
Yeah.
We get something out of that, couldn't we?
Yeah. What films has he done?
Snakes on a Plane.
Really?
Yeah.
Especially.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
We all know the work of George Ward. Come on, guys. Wow. Come on, guys.
See now, what else has he done?
Snakes on a Plane.
Snakes on a Plane 2. Yeah.
When you've seen Snakes on a Plane, you don't really need to watch
it. It kind of was a Pinnacle, to be fair, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, did well. Won his trial. Can't ask for any more than that, really. Doesn't win his races by very far.
No.
And a horse going Epsom, he doesn't win his races by very far, would concern me, because you can't really just drop your head on the line in the Derby, can you? So he'll go there. We know William Haggis doesn't run horses and races for the sake of it. So, you know, he's the sort of horse who would perform well, I imagine, but he doesn't quite have that X factor.
Yeah.
And just a point, and you may come onto the French classics in a minute, but we're talking about how well things are going for Ballard Oil.
Mm.
But the fillies are doing... We won two fillies classics so far this year, right?
Trials.
No, classics.
Oh, classics, sorry, yeah.
Mm. But those boys want stallions, and it's a real key time for them at the moment with Woodson Bassett gone and Galileo gone. So they could deal with one of these colts stepping forward and winning a Derby and putting themselves there. And I just wonder whether Diamond Necklace winning for St Mark's Basilica was perhaps the best result they've had this spring, because they can say, you know, newish sire, I mean, it's his first 3 years this year. We've got a classic winner, got a brilliant horse in Diamond Necklace. Maybe that's the one that John Magner and his team went, yes.
Yes, you need a flag bearer in this time ranks, don't they?
I will just jump in, Tom, and say it's sad that the Leopardstown winner, likely probably not going to go to Epsom by the sounds of it. They seem like they're looking at options, but seem like they were prioritising Ascot.
Well, he's part owned by Aussie Co, isn't he? Big Australian investor, and obviously we know
Kevin Blake as well, isn't he?
Yeah, we know from Harry Eustace's yard and the big Australian investment into his yard. Winners at Royal Ascot's all that Australian people want. So.
Yeah, let's have a word for Ryan Murr though, because he had the most unbelievable week at Chester, 5 from 8, made the right choice at Lingfield with Cameo and the Oaks Trial as well. He's riding at the very top of his game right now, isn't he, Maddie? But just as Sam, before the show, was saying he's the best since Leicester. What do you think?
I mean, I wasn't around when Leicester Pick was riding at his peak, but I can speak, you know, retrospectively looking at the replays I've seen. He's right up there, I'd say. For me, some of the rides, like even at Lingfield on Cameo, I thought she'd have a decent each way shout in the Oaks. I quite like what she did. But it's just the confidence. And I don't know whether this is something just I've noticed, but he seems more aggressive in the first half of the race these days to get a position. He was brilliant on Diamond Necklace as well in that respect. Obviously, it's easier when you have the horse to do it. We all know that. And he's in a privileged position to be riding these absolutely, you know, blue-blooded superstars. But I think he just has so much confidence in himself that he knows their limitations. He knows what they're capable of doing. So he's not afraid to ask them to do it, if that makes sense. And when you're riding with that amount of conviction and composure, you're just going to be one-upping everyone else at every corner. But yeah, I do think, I remember sort of, we're talking 10 years ago, I used to look at Ryan Moore and think, he rides very conservatively. He used to come from the back quite a lot. And I used to think, oh, if only you got them going earlier. And now I think he is being more proactive. And he rides, I think, more prominently on horses these days in a lot of scenarios. And that's what I like to see, because I think you get fewer hard luck stories. But he's just brilliant. His
ride on Lambourne, in the Huxley Stakes was...
Yeah.
Now that horse was not going to win anywhere apart from in the last, because he was at him. Yeah. And like, man, it's a bit like Paul Townend for Willie Mullins, right? Paul Townend is a brilliant jockey and he wins on the horses he should do, but also he can adapt and he can make horses win as well. So, you know, he's an exception.
I mean, I'd never have backed that horse at the price he went off, because, you know, you say 10 furlongs around Chester is the exact opposite of what he wants. First time out, a lot of those big guns coming on for the runs. And it was just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, well put, Maddie. And we've got some live news coming through from the Aidan O'Brien Gallops morning. We're hearing that Constitution River would be Ryan Moore's choice at Epsom, albeit they have said that they have a doubt over his ability to stay the mile and a half, and he could still go for the French Derby over 1 mile two. Diamond Necklace, it sounds like, going to go to France, but Precise and Amelia Earhart will go for Epsom. And Albert Einstein is apparently coming good at the right time and will run in the Sandy Lane. What do we think of that news?
I'm pleased that Albert Einstein's on the show.
Yeah.
It's always good to bring Albert Einstein in, make sure he's still there, still burning up the gallop, still doing great things. Yeah. I think Constitution River will stay. Mm. They'll stay and they'll win. And we can spend the rest of the year getting him confused with Constitution Hill.
Well, I'm gonna come to you and ask. It's great to have another Constitution in there, isn't it? Before we go to give your take on the Derby, let's just quickly turn to the Dante this week's big trial. In fact, the biggest of all the Derby trials, shaping up to be a really interesting race. Christmas Day in there, who of course beat James J. Braddock in the Valley Sags, heading the Antipost Market, and Morshdi, the William Haggis trained Fielding winner, who was rerouted from Kester after that, what did you call it? Ground?
Kerfuffle.
Mm. Is sort of just behind or even co-favourite with some. What do we think, Maddie?
Yeah, I would be a bit lukewarm on Christmas Day just because I don't think he was anything like the number one sort of Derby hope going into that Ballysacks. I think that was a case of the right horse at the right time rather than the best horse. But could be wrong. We see that, you know, the Ballydoyle battalions get reshuffled. I would expect that Benvenuto Cellini would still be better than him. I would hope he would be better than him, just the way that their careers have played out. But he's a very talented horse. The one horse who I think could run, I'm not sure if he was among the decks, was the Blue Ribboned trial winner. By Saxon Warrior Street.
Saxon Street, yeah.
I was wanting the second word, Saxon Street. Yes, I thought he was pretty good at Epsom. Yeah. I like the way he put daylight between himself and the second and third. That form not worked out brilliantly, but that was only his second run. And for me, I look at the Derby and I think, right, what can I leapfrog the market on? What can I get a price on that could shorten? And I think if he did run, I think his best price 20-1 at the minute, Saxon Street. I think if he ran well in the Dante, he could be single figures. So that's my kind of thinking. But I think Benvenuto Cellini is the right favourite at the minute. That Constitution River news has surprised me a little bit, but I guess they have put the doubt in there about the trip, and I do kind of share that.
Interesting. While there's that doubt, also Ryan Moore's likely ride.
Yeah.
Slightly.
It's from this.
It makes you a bit cold on Benvenuto Cellini, doesn't it? It
raises certain questions, doesn't it? Yeah. Mm. Where would the Peter Scargo pound be going on the Antipost Market?
We all know that it's not a good idea to be asking me for tips, Tom.
No.
Yes, I've done it. It can't possibly be a good idea.
Where not to put their money?
Well, certainly not. Of all the trial winners so far, I've liked Constitution River the best.
Yeah,
you were right, Pete.
Ryan and I often agree on things. We speak at length about this sort of stuff, so I'm not surprised you're for it. Look, we'll see how it plays out. But ultimately, I think we'd all be surprised if the Derby's won by
him more than Benvenuto Cellini.
That's not the way he whipped around the course. He made put real distance between them at the end, like a good 10 furlong. Sorry, good mile and a half horse should.
Epsom done. Let's just pause briefly on the Chester kerfuffle before we say goodbye to last week's action. Because it turned into one of the big talking points, didn't it? You know, I mean, over an hour break while delegations went out and prodded the ground a bit and they put sand down and so forth, horses slipping. Tom Marquand decided he wasn't going to take his ride. Maureen Haggis didn't see the horse. I think probably the worst thing about it, though, was the sort of complete absence or relative absence of communication for those on the track, who some of them were left trying to tune into ITV to find out what the hell was going on.
Yeah, apparently the public address was not, you couldn't hear it at all at the track. I wasn't there, so I can't speak for that. But yeah, that communication's clearly not ideal. I do sympathise with them, but at the same time, I think it makes for a really uncomfortable feeling when you've got, I didn't watch it, but I've been told that sort of jockeys were asked their view on it, and they were sort of saying, yeah, I'll ride, but you could tell that they really didn't want to. And I think when jockeys are kind of being backed into a corner to take mounts that they don't feel is safe to take is just a really, you know, we should be putting our faith in jockeys and their verdicts.
It's a little bit dangerous, isn't it? Yeah, because if one of them did fall and suffer a serious accident, you can imagine the fallout.
And, you know, Tom Markram coming out and saying, I am prepared to, you know, he's in a position of power and, you know, the Haggis team trust him implicitly. And for him to come out and say, I mean, I do sympathise because he was talking about the safety of the track before they made the changes. So, you know, he has no way of knowing whether it would be safe enough after they put the sand on and cut the grass and made the whatever. But to me, to be, you know, an interviewer and interviewing jockeys and they're saying or giving the clear impression they're not happy, but they're still going to be forced to ride is a horrible PR disaster waiting to happen. The fact nothing did happen was brilliant and it vindicated the team for doing what they did. And I have to praise them for that because, you know, we have to have trust in them that, you know, this is their job. This is what they do best. But at the same time, it so easily could have gone a different way. And I think we have to be mindful of the different kinds of risks when we're making these decisions. But yeah, that was the public address, one thing, but that was my take out is just from a sort of an outer perspective view. You can't be basically backing racing's participants who are putting their life on the line into a corner and saying, well, now X has deemed it safe, so you have to go out there and ride. You know, I think everyone, we should be hopefully in a position where everyone should be allowed to make their own decisions and not coerced into riding if they deem it unsafe.
Yeah, and lower stakes, but it wasn't the only ground issue. There was a tough little meeting for Chester because they also had a bit of a disagreement over what the going was, where we had the going description, which sort of indicating one thing. We had the going stick readings kind of indicating it might be slower than that. And then the actual times indicating something else again. Not great. You have sympathy with Clark's the course, Pete.
I can sympathise when you have to deal with the great British weather and what may or may not be coming. But in the end, to have three inconsistent readings like that, I mean, it can't be that hard.
It's not good for punters, is it?
I mean, good for punters. It's not good for the people participating. So it can't be that difficult to provide an accurate description. And, you know, we had the issues last year with the going stick readings being falsified or not given at Thirsk.
Yeah.
You know, they need to have punters and participants need to have faith in what's going on, and the clerks need to step up and do it properly.
It's a hard job being a clerk, isn't it?
I don't know. Is that difficult, really? Oof. Well, no. I mean, in the end, your job is to produce a fair racing surface with an accurate going description. So,
is it not that we all have a disagreement over what a fair racing surface is now? I mean, we saw that at Sandown, didn't we? People are now saying, you know, good firms should never be. Or even good should never be seen.
There's sort of a political dimension as well. They're heavily motivated not to. Yeah. Obviously, they want people to run their horses. So that's. But in this case, and it does seem just maybe it was, well, the going description and the times indicated they were wrong.
Just a couple of points on the delay. The delay took too long. They got, you know, in the end, I suppose they ended up with the right decision because it was fine. But you can't take an hour to make a decision like that. Secondly, the groom's responsible for the 2-year-olds that ran in the race that was delayed. All credit to them because those horses looked incredibly well behaved and well looked after. Big experience for a 2-year-old at a course like Chester. So all credit to those. And thirdly, say I was watching the race with my wife Tina, and we both felt that, as I say, Tina put it forward that time sort of ITV Racing did as well as they could do in that, but they lack features around these big meetings. You know, something like the Breeders' Cup, there's always a feature, there's always a storyline, and you know, having something like that to feed in would have benefited the coverage and would have benefited the coverage in general. But I think ITV Racing could do more around the big meetings, not necessarily every Saturday,
an hour delay.
No, but I mean in general, There should be more. There should be more in that. I mean, not one that you could necessarily roll out for an hour delay, but just, you know, the coverage could be more dynamic.
Well, let's move on dynamically to the RCA crisis, because we're a week on from Ascot's decision that they were going to leave the Racecourse Association at the end of 2026. Been lots of developments since then, mainly around the actions of the other signatories to the ultimatum that was delivered earlier this year. As a reminder of what's been happening, following Lord Allen's resignation as BHA chair and the failure to establish an independent BHA board, the Jockey Club and four major independent courses, Ascot, Goodwood, Newbury and York, wrote to the RCA demanding reform of that organisation. They wanted more voice, a bigger voice for bigger tracks. They gave them until the end of April to meet that demand. That deadline passed and Ascot said, "You've not achieved what we were asking for." However, since then, the other signatories have all signaled that they will give the RCA time to conduct a governance review, two words that send fear into the hearts of all men, with a fresh deadline now expiring at the end of July. Pete, are they just doing this because they think that it makes them look like good citizens? They give the RCA time to do the work? Or do you think there's a realistic outcome that the RCA actually comes up with something that satisfies their demand that big courses get a greater say in how decisions are made?
What I would say, Tom, is never underestimate the power of the status quo. You know, there's been various points in our collective time covering British horse racing where you thought something might happen. There's some sort of spark whereby we'll ignite and something will change, which is what this letter and ultimately what Ascot have been trying to do. And as they've stood on the precipice, these organisations, they've all gone, do you know what? It looks a little bit broader than we thought about it. We'll just take a bit more time to steel our nerves. And during that time, a lot of things can happen. You know, there can be a lot of horse training, a lot of discussions going on, we've done quite well together over the years, guys, come on, we can work it out. And you lose that initial momentum that was going on. So fair play to Ascot for doing it. Fair play to Felicity Barnard and her team. They've really tried to drive things forward and they've really tried to make change. And really, they see the sport differently to how other people want. They want to encourage top quality racing and bring in horses from around the world and obviously domestically.
Put a little bit of color around that, Pete, because I think this is something that maybe hasn't been answered. It's a bit of an analog with politics where I feel there's been a very clear message from Ascot and indeed from the many people within the sport who have supported them, from the likes of John Gosden and other big trainers through to owners, syndicate managers, that change is needed. Mm-hmm. But that's perhaps at this stage, at least, quite an amorphous concept rather than something defined. Mm-hmm. What sort of change do people want to see? Do Ascot want to see?
The likes of Ascot and the co-signatories of the letter initially, albeit it's only Ascot have gone out, they have a vision of racing being driven by the top end of high quality performance on the course, high quality horses in training, high quality narratives, to use one of those words, of horses going through the season, and people being drawn to the race course by this. It's not dissimilar to what Philip Newton and the people behind Project Pace are trying to do, albeit in a slightly different way. And Ascot is an incredible success story. Royal Ascot brings in tens of thousands of people. It's covered all over the globe. People build their years around it. They've had awards for their promotion of it. The whole thing is a great success story, and they use it to leverage soft power as well. It's very important for British racing, Britain in general, that opportunity to speak to people in a different. So Ascot basically want to harness this success to drive the sport forward, because at the moment we've got falling foal crops, got there in the end, falling betting, and a model that isn't going to be sustainable as we move in to a regime of higher taxation on bookmakers and the dreaded affordability check. So they're trying to get ahead of the game as best they can in that sense. And they were trying to drag others with them.
Yeah.
But the others.
Does that lead to a two-tier sport then? Is that where we're heading? You know, this very Japanese model.
Very possibly, yeah. Very possibly. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
I know.
It's only gonna happen, of course, if some other tracks sort of follow them into the breach, Maddie. I mean, you know, what was your view on the response from those other signatories?
A bit disappointing, if I'm honest, Tom. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about giving the RCA more time to sort of fulfill this mystery criteria, this reform. They've already had time. Like, Ascot set out a time frame for them to achieve their goals, and they didn't do it. I think that's very fair for Ascot to turn around and go, well, hang on, we weren't really keen on what you were proposing anyway, and you haven't delivered it. Yeah. So it is kind of a bit spineless, understandable, but spineless from some of the other large independents to go, oh, well, you know, we'll give them a bit longer and see and da da da. I think if anything, we're learning, I mean, it didn't work out very well with Lord Allen, but we're learning that maybe we just need a bit of aggression from somewhere when it comes to making these decisions to actually change British racing. Because for so long, we go round in this fragmented mess where everyone acts in their own interests, no progress is made, there's no cohesive strategy, and it's just a disaster. And that is time that we can't afford to waste if we want to see British racing prosper. So I do think it was quite disappointing. That said, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people at the RCA doing their best in a bad situation. It's not necessarily their fault that racing is structured in the way it is. Mm. But their organisation clearly needs to adapt and deal with the challenges that it's presented in a more effective way, i.e. their vetoing strategy and the fact that it's one course, sort of having one vote, etc., which we touched on last week.
Yeah, I thought one interesting news angle from last week that sort of highlighted the pace of change or the lack of pace in Britain was the announcement by the French racing authorities that they were going to launch a task force.
Oh, how refreshing.
A capital letters task force. I like that in particular, which is going to put forward a new model, a new financial model, new business model for the sport by the beginning of next year. And you just think, you know, that's obviously coming in response to some real challenges in French racing. Huge. Where they can see the income that they derive from the PMU, which is still quite heavily retail weighted, declining. They've had to cut prize money, and they have gone, well, this is not working, we need to change. And you think, well, in British racing, you know, we've had betting turnover falling year on year since 2021. We've had the impact of affordability checks. We've had attendances until last year falling as well. And there is, by contrast, an absence of activity.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you have to differentiate. They are different structures. You know, France Gallo have a lot more power over their race courses and their fixtures than we do in Britain. But the sort of acknowledgement of, okay, we have a significant problem. This is an effective way to deal with it. We're going, not only are we putting this task force together, but we want sort of material answers, and we're setting deadlines that, you know, we're going to meet to deal with this. It's just so refreshing. And we can't even do that in Britain because we know that we wouldn't be able to action them.
Yeah.
I think French racing, you know, has problems with the sort of the PMU structure of things, and quite an aging fan base, I would say, is probably the first problem. Mm. Britain, we're doing better in certain ways. You know, our attendances are looking great. I do think we're attracting a lot of young people to the sport. But it's, you can't directly compare them because, as I say, they're different in the way the organisations are built. But it just makes us feel even more stagnated, doesn't it? That we can't progress and they can.
Nah, it's great. It's always good looking across somewhere else with envy.
Yeah,
so there we are.
It's all we have to do. The French as well. I mean, like, if that's not going to motivate people in Britain,
this is it. This is it. Thank you, France Gallo, for giving us the kick up the backside we need.
Absolutely.
I would say as well, found it really interesting seeing who was on this task force.
Yeah.
A real array of really powerful and influential people who I'm sure will have
combining senior positions in trench racing with business experience.
Really smart. So I'm really interested to see what they come up with, and
totally
can't wait to see what we do.
Well, indeed. The next deadline will be end of July, so we will be keeping a close eye on that. But let's turn to our last big story of the week, which is the Breeze Up sales. The Breeze Ups, of course, are sort of one of the sport's most interesting, intrigue-filled, and reliable sense of the health of the underlying sport. Who's in the market? What prices are they buying at? And what's the confidence? And it's fair to say this year that the confidence levels have been pretty low. And then the numbers from the British sales in particular are really hard to ignore. Tattersall's Craven was down 18% year on year. Tattersall's Guinness down 24%. Goff's Doncaster down 29%. That seems to have been a little bit more robust at Arcana over the weekend. Pete, what's your take on the state of the market, and what does that tell us about the health of European racing?
Well, we've had some quite inflated markets the last couple of years, particularly with Godolphin and Ammo Racing buying big. Both have scaled back quite significantly this year. So that's going to, people talk about the readjustment that's going on as a consequence. It basically means that people aren't spending as much money as they were before for one reason or another. The Breeze Ups are always quite interesting because it's a very hit and miss. So you'll get, well, it's making huge sums of money if they've hit all the markers in their breeze. And they're so data driven now, these breezes, the amount of data people extract from them.
Go into
and
that
use.
A bit. Like, what data is it? All the sort of striding stuff,
stride length, and times, splits, runouts. People even go as far as, you know, assessing confirmation walks, you know, from the walking videos and what have you. And if you hit all those markers, your quid's in.
Is it that simple?
I think so. Yeah, and but if you don't, you are struggling. Or you've often invested quite a lot of money to get there. But all these yearlings for, in some cases, a lot of money that you've tried to spin onto the, you know, Breeze Up sale. So the top of the market's held up okay by comparison. You know, you've had Victorious Forever have bought again, which, you know, given what's been going on in the Middle East.
Let's talk about who's been buying and who's not been buying, because that's really interesting. You already mentioned Victorious together, so that's a sort of Bahraini operation.
Sheikh Nasser and Sheikh Khaled.
Exactly. Wathnan
have also it'll be interesting on Wathnan how we go in this period now, because they normally go on their Royal Ascot spending blitz.
Yes.
You know, they bought Gethin the other day with Owen Burrows. You know, now you do, yeah. So we're interested to see whether, you know, with what's going on in
at
least whether Wathnan go on this same spree that they've gone on in the past 2 years.
Indeed, yeah. The as you mentioned, Godolphin though, less apparently
Absalon to Arcana. Yeah. Stepped in to buy Arcana. Ammo a bit quieter. It's not spending at the same levels they were, certainly over here, as in Europe.
Yeah.
Ace Stud, which is the, you know, the European arm of the European affiliates of Yulong, Jixing Zhang, they bought a bit as well, you know, building on their continued sort of expansion within the market. So you've got a few players around, but it's thinner than it is in the States. I mean, if you look at the sales prices we're talking about over here, I think there's one that made 1.1 million euros, but I don't think anything else breached that seven figure mark. Whereas in the States, there are plenty of horses making a million, including Zayden. I once had a guy that bought a share in a horse for his dad, right? And the horse turned out to be quite good. So he just took the share himself and it wasn't his dad's anymore. So this 10 million,
his dad ever knew.
This $10 million horse.
$10.5 million.
$10.5 million that was named after the guy's dad. Uh-huh. If it turns out to be a Kentucky Derby horse, would end up being named after him instead.
Is it the same guy?
Well, it's the same name.
Same guy.
I see. No. I wasn't. No, Amir Zeidan didn't invest in mice. But I thought, you know, it's always nice to name it after somebody. But if it turns out to be very good, you put quite like to name after yourself. Yeah, but like, obviously, we know with all the tax breaks in America.
So these are Trump's super trades. So the money, the smart money is obviously moving there because of these tax breaks. But I think that there's another thing which is really important here, which is the sort of underlying reliance on a very small handful of big operations, which has a twin effect. One, when one or two of them steps back, it leaves a massive hole. But two, it also leaves a situation where buyers feel they can compete with those big operations for the better horses, and so affects their strategy. And so when you do have a pullback for the big operations, there's nothing there to fill the gap.
And a lot of the buyers in the first, as in the buyers who they're tending to be the vendors as the breeze up guys, so bought as yearlings, sellers as breeze up horses, they will have reasonably high expectations of what they want their horses to make. So that adjustment has to take place as well. And I think in James Thomas's most recent report on Arcana, you see some of the buyers at that who bought the horses saying, the vendors came in with quite high expectations and they've had to adjust their levels as the season's gone on. So there's that as well. And obviously that then feeds onto the yearling sales and whether these guys are going to be prepared to go in deep again. So it's a
case of, similarly to what we were talking about with the RCA, is almost it turns into two tiers of like the very elite and then the rest. I mean, the days of sort of some syndicate like buying into all sort of sales and then, are they gone now, do you think?
No,
it's just not as accessible as it once was?
I don't think necessarily. But someone like the breeze up sales, we talked about the data, like, you know, you ain't going to get a syndicate buying the top horse in that. So, you know, you're having to settle for something else, or you're trying to see an angle somewhere that may or may not pay off.
Is it harder to do that now, do you think?
The playing field isn't as level.
Yeah.
As it was, there's definite advantages both in money and technology.
And are there going to be downstream consequences of this, Pete, or is it just a cyclical correction?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the old cyclical approach. Huh? I didn't like it when we talked about British and Irish jump racing either. I think that's a cop out to say it's cyclical. We are too reliant in Europe on a very shallow base of big buyers. And without changes to the racing product to encourage more people to come in, that's going to become more problematic.
Which brings us back to the RCA and Ascot conversation, the necessity of actually having a ball.
It's all linked up. This isn't a big revelation. It's all linked up. And that's why Ascot being so proactive and trying to get something done, you know, this is why there's plenty of red lights flashing about. So we'll see. But, you know, I'm sure there's something to be jolly about, Tom. Ryan Moore's Riley Constitution River in the Derby. You know, we're home and hosed near enough.
I've got two other notes here. I've got affordability latest and equine influenza.
So. Good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Then. So we'll save those for another day.
We will. Since I've said them, I'll very quickly say affordability latest is the decision is going to be later this month. We think May 21st is when the Gambling Commission will actually decide. And equine influenza, Plumpton lost their meeting due to a case in a adjoining livery yard. Worrying, because we sort of forget about it after COVID came along and cancelled everything, but we obviously had 6 days without racing due to an equine influenza outbreak in 2020 or 2019?
2019, yeah.
Anything to worry about there?
It's not good that it's about. It's non-thoroughbreds at the moment. It's mostly unvaccinated horses. Yeah. The BHA seemed quite on top of it, and they did put in changes after the equine influenza outbreak where the horses are now vaccinated twice a year. So there's mitigations in place. But, you know, with horses moving around and with people moving between horses, you know, there is always the risk. So good biohazards. Measures, please, everybody. Wash your hands. Yeah. Was it a happy birthday we had to do back at the start of COVID? Wash your hands to happy birthday.
It was, yes.
All that sort of stuff. Back in those glorious days.
Back in those glorious days.
All of that sort of stuff. Yeah. Fantastic. Good. Excellent. Good biohazard health. Please.
Always good to finish on a public health message, I find. And that's all we've got time for. But we do have a massive week ahead. We obviously have the Dante meeting. We have the first Group 1 for older horses in the lock-in to Newbury. So we'll be back next Monday to talk through all of that. And I'm sure lots more beside. In the meantime, stay tuned to all the Racing Post channels as we'll have the latest on the Epsom Countdown and everything else happening in the world of racing. Thank you very much to my panelists. Thank you to you for joining us. Until next time.